Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Tuesday, March 31. Thanks for tuning in. We've got another big show coming up this morning, starting in Vanuatu, where a powerful 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck overnight. Also, Pacific tourism operators find optimism in the surging global fuel prices.
The entire industry is preparing a collaborative approach to how we can create opportunities out of these challenges.
And we find out why security experts hold fears for the safety of Guam. We've got all that and more coming up. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, it's been a tense night for the people on the island of Santo in Vanuatu after a powerful 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck late last night. The quake hit about 30 kilometres from Luganville, deep underground, and while no tsunami warning was issued, the shaking was felt across the country, including in the capital, Port Vila. For the latest, we're joined now by the ABC's Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell, who's in Port Vila. Lily Rose, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kyle.
So what was it like where you were when the quake hit?
Here in Port Vila, the quake struck around 7:44 in the evening. The shaking was slow but strong enough to interrupt traffic and daily routines. Some vehicles pulled over as drivers felt the ground moving and people had to step out of the vehicles. Others left their homes, or those who were still in their workplaces had to run outside as a precaution. The movement felt like a steady rolling motion, and while there was no widespread damage in the capital, it caused concerns last night.
Yes, I imagine it would have been triggering for a lot of people. What are you hearing from people closer to the epicenter on Santo? Like, how strong was the shaking there?
From Luganville and surrounding areas, reports suggest much stronger shaking. People describe it as a sudden shock, like followed by heavy movement. There were goods were fallen from shelves in shops, and some buildings have developed cracks. Eyewitness accounts say many families, especially students and those with children, were frightened and choose to stay outside overnight, sleeping on mats on open ground for safety, and because they were traumatized.
Yeah, I have seen some of those photos trickle out, places like supermarkets and things like that, with, you know, all the food falling off the shelf. Do we have any confirmed reports of major damage or injuries or anything like that?
At this stage, there was no authorities say there's still no confirmed injuries at this stage. However, there is visible structural damage to some buildings and disruption to essential services. Last night, there was a temporary power outage that affected large parts of Santo, including the neighboring island, and also there was a temporary disruption to water supply.
It is Monday, March 30, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm chatting to the ABC's Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell, about an earthquake that shook the island of Santo last night. So, Lily Rose, what's the government response been so far? Are emergency teams on standby?
The government response is focused on assessment preparedness. There are disaster management committees in those affected provinces, and they're collecting information and meeting to review damage and coordinate next steps with the national government. The emergency services were on standby, and particularly in Sanma province, where there's a lot of reported damages to structural buildings and goods. The Vanuatu Meteorological and Geohazards Department continues to monitor the situation. They have put out information and have been issued public advisories.
I see. Now, 7.2 magnitude, it's not a small earthquake, and I know you're no stranger to earthquakes living in Vanuatu. How does this one compare to the December 2024 earthquake?
Well, you know, Vanuatu is located in a highly active seismic zone, so earthquakes are relatively common. This earthquake, while strong at magnitude 7.2, appears to have caused less damage than the December 2024 earthquake. And one key reason the officials say was that it is around about 100 kilometers underground, which reduced the level of destruction on the surface. But there were concerns. People were calling into the Vanuatu Meteorological and Geohazards Department to ask questions, especially those on the island of Ambai, where there's an active volcano. So most of the communities on the northern part of the island did not experience the December 2024 earthquake in the same way where a lot of people from Sheffield province have experienced it. And but for them, it was still unfamiliar and quite distressing, even though the physical damage appears less. There's not reported injuries or death. It appears less severe, but the experience has been more unsettling for those communities.
Yes, I can imagine. And finally, what's the advice to communities this morning? Are there concerns about aftershocks or anything like that?
There were concerns. The concerns that remain from aftershocks concerns is still a concern. The Hazards Department has put out advisories and is saying, advising people to stay alert, especially in those affected areas. While there's no information on whether they will be continuing after shocks, they did advise people to stay alert. Have been urged to remain cautious, and people are being asked to check for damages in their homes or for unsafe buildings, and for official updates as more information becomes available.
Yes, let's hope people do take those precautions. Lily Rose, that's all we've got time for this morning, but thanks so much for coming on the program and giving us that update.
You're welcome, Kyle. Thank you.
That was the ABC's reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wellwell.
Yo, Michael Chow, jump in. We're late for work.
Jacob Quiet, whose car is this? So flashy. It's even got digital radio.
Hey, what can I say? Your boy's doing all right.
ABC Radio Australia.
Is that ABC Radio Australia on digital radio?
My guy, I forgot to tell you. We're now broadcasting Pacific voices, stories and music right across Australia in your car, at home, wherever there's DAB+.
So my auntie in Brisbane can finally stop asking me for streaming instructions?
Exactly. Just tell her to find ABC Radio Australia on digital radio. It's that easy.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, the continued escalation of war in the Middle East is having a drastic impact on the global economy, the Pacific Islands included. Everywhere, fuel prices are surging with the disruption of energy supplies impacting the price of food, household energy and transportation is rising. Travel has also been hit hard with airfares going up and flights cancelled. Pacific countries are on the precipice of feeling the full impact of the fuel crisis, but tourism operators are hoping it could lead to more visitors. Finau Fanua files this report.
The Strait of Hormuz is closed, according to a statement from Iran's Revolutionary Guards today. They vowed a severe response to any ship trying to get through.
The Middle East produces over 30% of the world's crude oil, and most of it is exported through the Strait of Hormuz. The narrow waterway has been virtually closed since the US and Israel launched attacks on Iran, causing fuel prices to surge around the world. Despite their distance from the conflict, Pacific Island countries are not immune to these shocks.
These external shocks are felt deeply in our economy, in our transport sector.
Tonga's Prime Minister Lord Whakawhanua held a press conference last Friday and addressed the crisis. With monthly petrol and diesel prices expected to be announced this week, the cost is expected to be high, and the government is urging the public to avoid using fuel.
What we hope, and I ask you to pray, is that the war will end within these 2 months. If it continues through April, May, and into June and July, we will be in a critical and dangerous situation.
Samoa's Prime Minister Lauli Smit has also addressed the issue, saying government's immediate priority was to ensure the country had enough fuel supply.
Our priority now is to make sure we have enough supply. And we have just discussed with Honourable Prime Minister in terms of assistance, because what's happening now, we never know what's the protection of the supplying and the cost, because we can't control that. We never know what's going to happen next, because the war doesn't end, I don't know.
Airlines have already taken a big hit, with airfares going up and flights being cancelled. Just 2 weeks ago, Air New Zealand announced a cut in over 1,000 flights, including some to the Pacific. With travel reduced, the concern is that it could undermine tourist visits to the Pacific nations.
Fiji, that's where you want to be.
For Fiji, the most popular tourist destination in the Pacific, the impact on visitor numbers are a particular concern. CEO for the Tourism Association of Fiji, Fantasia Lockington, says the Fiji government has initiated an action plan.
We are talking with government about reviewing, for example, the departure tax during this time. The other thing that we're doing is the entire industry is preparing a collaborative approach to how we can create opportunities out of these challenges. We know fuel price increases will ripple across the economy. It'll raise transport, freight, and even production costs. And we know that this is going to drive inflation and potentially make Fiji more expensive.
She's optimistic Fiji's tourism industry could pull through and says global flight cancellations could be a blessing in disguise as Australians and New Zealanders look for travel destinations closer to home.
The entire industry is preparing a collaborative approach to how we can create opportunities out of these challenges, this particular challenge, in fact. So we're working together to ensure that we create the opportunities by making sure that we've got very comprehensive and very affordable packages for potential visitors to consider.
Another blessing in disguise is that oil-producing countries have more demand, and that means more revenue. One of those countries is Papua New Guinea.
PNG LNG project has had a long-lasting impact, contributing more than 28 billion kina to the state of Papua New Guinea.
Han Freitas, World Bank's Division Director for Papua New Guinea, says whilst local consumers suffer, government revenue increases.
PNG exports oil and imports fuel. So in a sense, what will happen with rising fuel prices, that people will feel the impact of that at the pump and when they pay their electricity bill. At the same time, over time, the government will also make more revenues because it's exporting oil.
Chris Cocker, CEO of the South Pacific Tourism Organization, says a recent meeting between representatives of Fiji's tourism industry were visibly concerned by the crisis.
The Middle East crisis was raised up on its impact. I could see it's still very early, and as you probably are aware, that the Pacific are usually the last frontier to hit. But they are aware of it, and for example, Fiji has reactivated their tourism action groups.
Mr. Cocker says for most of the region, tourist numbers remain stable, and like others, say global flight cancellations could be a blessing in disguise.
We are the most safest because we are most furthest. So not only would the fuel prices go up, but we also have an advantage there for us to capitalize on as a safe destination. Not only sun, sand, sea, but safety as well. So four S's. The thing that we've learned is we are very resilient because we've gone through pandemics, we've gone through cyclones. These are external pressures. We just hope that it will be sorted out so that things will be back to normal, because it's not only affecting travel into the Pacific, but globally.
That was Chris Cocker, CEO of the South Pacific Tourism Organization, ending that report from Whanua. Police in Australia have charged some of the crew of a boat that was intercepted near French Polynesia earlier this year carrying several tons of cocaine with attempting to bring a further ton of the drug into Australia. In January, French authorities boarded the MV Raider and dumped almost 5 tons of cocaine found on board into the sea before letting the boat go and its before letting the boat and its 11 crew go. Last month, the boat turned up in Sydney after issuing a distress call for mechanical issues and low supplies, and the crew was later put into immigration detention. Now, in an extraordinary development, Australian Federal Police claim French authorities failed to find a further ton of cocaine hidden in a specially built smuggling hide. Joining us now with further details is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedget. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Kyle.
So, yeah, pretty complex stuff. So they were initially caught with 5 tons of cocaine, which was destroyed by French authorities. And now we're hearing there's an additional 1 ton that those authorities didn't find, yet we haven't yet seen that. So did Australian authorities find an extra ton of cocaine on the MV Raider?
No, they didn't, Kyle, and it's worth clearing this up because a few media outlets, unfortunately, have slightly misunderstood what the police are saying here and reported that they found an extra ton of cocaine on board the ship. Now, I've spoken with police, and that is not what has happened. The ton was not discovered on board, and the MV Raider didn't have this additional ton on board when it limped into Sydney Harbour earlier this month, escorted by Border Force. What's happened is that Australian authorities now feel like they've got enough evidence to prove to an Australian court that French Polynesian authorities missed an additional ton of cocaine on top of that almost 5 tons that they dumped in the sea, and that additional ton of cocaine remained in one of these specially built smuggling hides on board the MV Raider well beyond January, definitely into March when it was coming into Australia's EEZ. Now, what we don't know is what happened to that ton of cocaine. Police have obviously found the place it was hidden, and they've got evidence, they say, on the electronic devices that they've seized showing that there was at least an attempt by members of this crew to contact an Australian-based criminal syndicate in an attempt to hand it over. But what they have not said and will not tell us is whether they believe that that attempt was successful. So it seems like there was another ton of cocaine on board that was still on the ship when it entered into Australia's waters, and that the crew did allegedly try to smuggle it, but it's not clear whether that was successful or not. In other words, it's possible that the ton of cocaine was dropped over the side of the board and then picked up by an Australian syndicate via boat. It's possible, although I struggle to understand how this is going to happen if the ship is being tracked very closely by the Australian Navy and by Border Force. But it's possible, I guess, that they managed to hand it over to a ship that came from the Australian mainland. But it's also possible, of course, that they made this attempt to smuggle it and that they weren't successful and that they were forced in the end to dump that last ton of cocaine into the sea as the other 5 tons were dumped near French Polynesia before issuing its distress call and coming into Sydney Harbour. So there's plenty here that isn't yet clear, but it is an extraordinary story.
It really is. Yeah, we were tracking this vessel and we were watching it just sort of loiter off the coast of Australia for a number of days before turning around and heading back the direction it came, and then coming back again. It was, yeah, we were really speculating as to what it might be doing. So what evidence are police relying on that they may have, you know, smuggled or moved these drugs on?
Well, two main things. One, the existence of this additional smuggling hide. So the French authorities found two, I'm told, relatively straightforward smuggling hides. But then there was this third one, which they didn't discover, where police allege a ton of cocaine was still hiding, which police only discovered about 5 or 6 days ago whilst the MV Raider was in Sydney Harbour. And if you look at some of the pictures that police have released and some of the videos, it's pretty extraordinary. It looks like the smugglers went to a very elaborate effort to try and hide this cocaine. It looks like the area where it was where the drugs were allegedly secreted might have been underneath a cupboard and through a tunnel, right in the base of the vessel. So, a really expensive, elaborate, and sophisticated attempt to hide these drugs. So that's the first bit of evidence. But the other evidence that they seem to have is essentially messages or other forms of evidence from the phones and electronic devices that they've recovered from the drug smugglers. So we don't know for sure, but presumably police have picked up some sort of communication between Australian-based syndicates and this crew or some of these crew members they believe points towards at least an attempt to smuggle this cocaine into Australia. But the precise details are not clear. I suspect we'll learn more when this case comes to court.
Yeah, so I understand that not all of the crew have been charged. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Six of the 11 crew members have been charged. So I don't know exactly why that is. My guess is that they've got enough evidence, when you look at the electronic devices and the like, to be able to prove to a court that at least these six knew what was happening and were in some way involved. The other five, they obviously haven't reached that threshold, which doesn't necessarily mean that the other five members were completely ignorant as to what was going on. They may have been, they may not have been, but whatever the reality there, the police simply don't have the evidence to charge them. So that's why only about half the crew have been charged.
I see. And for those that have been charged, do we know what charges they're facing?
Simply a conspiracy to smuggle a commercial quantity of prohibited drugs into Australia. So the basically drug smuggling. The exact charges that the people are hit with whenever they've got very large quantities of drugs, which they want to try and allegedly bring into Australia. So it's a pretty serious charge. It carries a maximum punishment of life in jail. Whether they're found guilty, whether they get that sentence or not, of course, we'll have to wait and see. But there's serious charges that have been levelled here.
Yeah. And do we know what will happen to the crew members who have not been charged?
Look, police haven't said exactly what will happen, but I think what's most likely is that they will be deported. I believe all crew members are from either Honduras or Ecuador. From memory, five of those who were charged are from Honduras and a sixth is from Ecuador. And I believe, from memory anyway, that all 11 members are from those two countries. So the remaining five members of crew, my expectation is at some point they'll be declared an illegal maritime arrival and they'll be put on a plane back to Honduras or back to Ecuador.
I see. And just finally, Dizzy, because we are running out of time, but you mentioned earlier it is such an extraordinary set of circumstances how this has all come about. Well, I mean, where does this all stack up in terms of, you know, cases like this you've reported on in the past? Is this among the most extraordinary?
Look, it is extraordinary, but it is not unprecedented in the sense that a lot of these vessels that we're seeing coming across the Pacific are increasingly sophisticated when you look at the methodologies and the money that they're using to retrofit some of these ships with these increasingly sophisticated hides. And it's a story you see often throughout the world, authorities missing cocaine or other forms of drugs that are hidden in parts of a vessel. So it is unusual, but it isn't unprecedented. Similarly, the decision to let these crew members go by the French Polynesian police, yes, unusual, but again, not unprecedented. There are many instances internationally where you find crews being let go even when drugs are found on board, because basically authorities make the calculation it's not worth their while to try and prosecute these people because they're so far down the food chain. And of course the model that you normally see, and it's I don't know exactly where these crew members fit in the chain of command that authorities allege exist here. In other instances we've seen previously that they are very much down the bottom, which is why authorities say, look, it's just not worth our while to prosecute. So in a sense, this is, you know, a pretty extraordinary, unusual story. In another sense, we have seen these trends broadly before. I think what the quantities here demonstrate, though, is just how vast the amounts of money are that are now you know, able to be made in this route, and just how brazen drug smugglers, you know, are now in terms of the tactics they use to try and get these drugs across the Pacific. And of course, the real shift that we've seen over the last couple of years, in particular, Kyle, as you know, is that Pacific Islands are no longer just way stations. Increasingly, we're seeing the spillover impacts, and local criminals and others, including the syndicates, are now looking for opportunities to get drugs into Pacific communities, either as a tool to recruit locals to help them get the drugs across to the major lucrative markets in Australia and a lesser extent into New Zealand, or because they feel they can make a small amount of money on the side. And as we've been reporting extensively, as Australian and other authorities have pointed out, as we've heard from police in Fiji, Tonga and elsewhere, this is just having a really awful and sometimes devastating impact on local communities in the Pacific. So the story of the MV Raider in one way is an extraordinary one with plenty of entertaining twists and turns. But on the other hand, you know, we shouldn't get too caught up in the, you know, all of the extraordinary drama of this. In the end, this is a story of alleged criminality. And in the end, what we see from this alleged criminality, speaking more broadly, is suffering across the Pacific, devastating impacts on families across the Pacific and in the lives of the people caught up in a really invidious trade.
Yeah, and that has all been tragic to watch it all play out, as you pointed out. And in terms of this particular case, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more still to come in regards to these men. Dizzy, that's all we've got time for today, but thanks so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thanks, Kyle.
That was the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. To Micronesia now, where a recent security assessment has delivered a sobering reality check for Guam and the risk it faces in a potential regional war between the US and China over Taiwan. The Pacific Centre for Island Security's 2025 Micronesia Security Outlook states military infrastructure projects in Saipan, Yap and Rota are a tacit admission that officials believe Guam could be destroyed in a real conflict. To find out more, we are joined by a former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives and current chair of the Pacific Centre for Island Security, Robert Underwood. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Kyle, and happy to be here.
Not a problem at all. Now, these projects in places like Yap, the Tinian Airfield, for instance, they've been well documented. Why do you see these projects as an admission that Guam, you know, could one day be destroyed in a real conflict?
Because up to now, Guam has as a base from which to project power into East Asia. And so it was seen as an offensive tool. But now that the Chinese have the capability to strike back and bring war into the immediate area, the United States military is planning to distribute and divert their resources all over the region. So in a sense, that really is an admission that in case of a real conflict, Guam will basically be destroyed, and that in order for the U.S. to have the capacity to strike back, they have to divert and disperse their resources.
It's very interesting. Often, you know, with these sorts of conversations, particularly with the U.S. government, ambiguous language is often thrown around. We often hear the word deterrent. But the point, I guess, that your paper makes is that a lot of this militarization, it sounds less like deterrence and more about insurance in case Guam is destroyed. Is that fair to say?
It's fair. You know, the whole notion in the past has been that you really are saying that if you're strong enough that your potential adversaries won't strike at you. But in this instance, you are really saying that your adversaries have the capacity to strike at you. And so, you know, it behooves the people of Guam and the surrounding Micronesian region to really assess what these trends portend for the island region and what its ultimate utilization is. And of course, in the process of conducting and militarizing these areas, Guam and the Northern Marianas are not consulted. In a sense, they're sort of handed memos. We're going to do this. And, you know, you can't really stop it. You can't really divert it. And you can't really block it.
You wrote in the paper as well that the Department of War Chief Pete Hegseth has actually framed Guam in the past in sort of a post-attack kind of way. What about that sort of language do you find most concerning?
Well, amongst the hundreds of things that Pete Hegseth says, which are pretty disturbing or, you know, erratic, actually, the characterization of Guam as a place that will be destroyed in a potential conflict means that we have to, we on Guam have to assess, what does that mean for us? In other words, in case the U.S. gets into a war, there's an acknowledgement that we'll be eviscerated. And potentially, as and remember, this publication has many different papers in it, including some from conservative thinkers and some from people who think about nuclear conflict, and also the possibility of so-called using limited nuclear weapons in our part of the world. And so it's very disturbing. We're a small island, and one nuclear weapon can pretty much wipe us out.
Now, your think tank, you obviously, you very much serve as a voice, particularly for Indigenous Islanders who don't have much of a voice in that part of a world. Does the public messaging within Guam, I guess, reflect the these U.S. intelligence assessments that, you know, for the most part, kind of look grim?
Well, there is a kind of a resignation, especially in the so-called U.S.-affiliated islands, that the U.S. can pretty much do what it wants. But, you know, given the state of affairs in the world today, where you have this war in Iran, where you have the U.S. Flexing itself and in a very uncertain, erratic, and unplanned way. We don't even know what the war is really about. It really, then, once the focus shifts back to the Indo-Pacific region, all of us who live in that part of the world have to kind of imagine what this world will look like. How can we make policy? The United States used to be the force for regulation, for regularity, for stability in the region. And now it is acting as a kind of a disruptor rather than a stabilizer.
Yeah, I want to flesh that war out a bit with you a little bit later in terms of the effect that it's having within Micronesia at the moment. I guess in terms of this paper, you know, it's very much a potential war with China that it touches on, and that's obviously theoretical. It's something that people speculate about, but you know, there's been no movement on that. But what is your current threat assessment of the Pacific region at the moment?
Well, the threat assessment is one that is based upon primarily upon U.S. Defense planning. So I think that the Chinese, of course, it continues to extend their influence. So China continues to extend its influence, and the United States is almost in a defensive posture, trying to block it almost and use this so-called second island chain, almost kind of like a Maginot line. If we can go back to World War II and how France thought that it could defend itself from Germany by a Maginot line. And so there's this kind of defensive thinking which anticipates that the other side will take the offense and we'll do everything we can to hold the line. But of course, that's not the real competition between China and the U.S. The real competition is about trade, not just about military.
Yeah.
It's about economic power. It's about the whole changing dynamics. And, you know, if you're from the U.S., you have to imagine that in 10 years, China is going to be the dominant economic power in the world, and it's going to exceed U.S. economic power. So if your only solution to that, if the only way that you can imagine counteracting that is through bolstering your military, you're kind of missing the whole point.
Are you saying that one day it's going to be inevitable that the U.S. will have to cede economic power eventually, whether it's 10, 20 years down the track?
Well, in order, for example, if people see that the Pacific Islands are a place where the U.S. and China are competing for influence and prestige, and the Chinese are expanding economically and offering economic packages, and the U.S. is offering nothing but more military, that's not the way to counteract it. Where's the U.S. business investment? Where's the U.S. economic investment? Where's the investment in soft power, in trying to win the hearts and minds of people? All of that has dissipated in recent years with the demise of aid, with the closing down of diplomatic missions in the island Pacific. So this is not, in my estimation, the way to go about it, even if you were just simply adopting a U.S. point of view. But of course, for us in the island Pacific, we have to imagine who's taking up our point of view. Who is consulting with us? And the reality is no one is consulting with us. So it's important that in this document that we've released, and you'll see that there's a number of islanders, you know, voices coming in from different parts of Micronesia, very intelligent voices that are positing, opening up an avenue for generating a Micronesian perspective on this so that we're not simply responding to initiatives from the outside.
Let's talk about what's going on in the Middle East at the moment, because it feels like, you know, for once the eyes of the world are off the Pacific as this war in Iran plays out. Has that altered military activity in your part of the world at all?
Well, what it's done is it's kind of shifted things around. Obviously, some of the, you know, it was anticipated for many years that they were going to move 5,000 Marines from Okinawa to Guam. And so this Camp Blas was constructed, half with Japanese money and half with U.S. money. So now those Marines aren't coming to Guam. They didn't want to come to Guam to begin with. Now, those very Marines that that are in the Persian Gulf, going towards the Persian Gulf, are defense forces that are coming from Okinawa. So it kind of points out the kind of vagaries of this and the erratic kind of nature of this conflict. And what it does is it reshapes everything back home. So now you have an $8 billion military base in Guam, which is basically vacant. And so what are they going to fill it up with? Now there's contemplation that they're going to bring U.S. Army troops in from Korea, or they might even post Japanese troops in on a rotational basis through Guam. All of this kind of elements of it, and it's all being conducted and thought of and planned for without consultation with the island leaders.
Oh, yeah, that's probably the saddest part of it all. And if you look at the latest reports, you know, there's no confirmation yet, obviously, but it might not be impossible to see boots on the ground or U.S. boots on the ground in Iran sometime soon. Would soldiers from Guam or even those based in Guam, as you just mentioned, likely play a part in that, do you think?
Well, yes. And actually, of course, many people from the islands, including the Northern Marianas and the Freely Associated States, are in the military. I can guarantee you that many of those troops that are on those ships awaiting are originally from the islands.
Yeah, and that's very sad to hear as well. Well, it's certainly for some it makes for some grim talking, unfortunately, Robert. But fascinating nonetheless. Look, that's all we've got time for today. But I want to thank you again for coming on our program and giving us some of that fantastic insight.
Okay, thank you, Kyle.
That was former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives and current chair of the Pacific Center for Island Security, Robert Underwood. And if you want to learn more about Guam, the ABC will be airing a special on the U.S. territory this week. You can catch that on the Pacific TV program this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. PNG time. And alternatively, you can track that down afterwards on ABC iView. It is Tuesday, March 31, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and if you're just tuning in, it's been a tense night for the people on the island of Santo in Vanuatu after a powerful 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck late last night. Meanwhile, a Pacific security think tank holds fears for the safety of Guam, saying military projects, military projects around Micronesia are a tacit admission that officials believe that Guam could one day be destroyed in a real conflict. And despite surging global fuel prices, Fiji tourism operators are optimistic the Middle East conflict might be good for business.
We're working together to ensure that we create the opportunities by making sure that we've got very comprehensive and very affordable packages for potential visitors to consider.
Stay tuned, because coming up, we'll get the latest on a large amount of cocaine that was found on a stricken yacht in Vanuatu. The recent discovery of a large amount of cocaine on a stricken yacht in Vanuatu has raised concerns about the risks the international drug smuggling trade poses for local communities. Earlier this month, 1.6 tonnes of cocaine was found on the deck of the yacht in a smile after it ran aground on Ifate Island. A British man and a Lithuanian man have been arrested, with police suspecting Australia was the boat's intended destination. Regardless, it's shocked locals like Jane Yatika, president of the Port Vila Council of Women, who's worried about the harm washed up narcotics could have on children and young people. She also tells our reporter, Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Well, that the cocaine has to be destroyed transparently.
Not only is the drug themselves is a danger, but we also have other impacts that can affect the children and the young people in the community. It is with curiosity that our children may find some packages along the seashore, or bricks of a substance along the seashore, washed ashore by the sea, and not knowing what it is, they can pick them up and then inhale, try to smell what it is.
What action or support would you like to see from the government moving forward, and especially in handling this this issue?
I'd like to see, or the people, or the women in Port Vila would like to see that we encourage reporting suspicious yachts or strangers to the Vanuatu police force and to the local chiefs immediately. We encourage them not to approach the vessels that are suspicious. I would like to call on the police that while destroying these substances after the investigation, they should have some chiefs and some other leaders of the communities that the yacht ran aground on Norte Fate. They should be there to witness the burning of the substances. There shouldn't be anybody around the place while burning the substances. Only the people that are there to witness the burning of the drugs. Because we do trust the police, yes, we do trust them, but sometimes we'll never know what can happen. So we need people there to witness the burning of the drugs, and we have to restrict children going there during, because some children don't go to school, so we have to restrict the area during the time of burning. An additional that I would like to add here is we have to teach our children never to touch or open a wrapped package that is found along the beach. Treat them as sea mines and dangerous explosives. Talk to the youth about the reality of these drugs and explain that they aren't easy money, but death and prison for the community.
That was Jane Yatika, president of the Port Vila Council of Women, speaking there with Lily Rose Well. To rugby league now, and media made their minds up a couple of days ago, but now it's official. Willie Peters will be the inaugural coach of the PNG Chiefs NRL team. The former Rabbitohs and Dragons halfback will join the club at the end of the current rugby league season in England, where he remains in charge of the reigning Super League and World Cup champions Hull Kingston Rovers. Now that the Chiefs management working with the Australian Rugby League Commission, have sealed the deal. Speculation over which players will be joining Peters is certain to intensify. And the Chiefs General Manager, Michael Chalmers, has told the media in Port Moresby that there is no shortage of interest. He's also explained why Willie Peters got the coaching job ahead of other leading candidates like former Kumul Adrian Lamb and current Kumul's coach, Jason Demetrio.
To the PM and the people of Papua New Guinea, I look forward to building strong relationships with you all and earning your trust. What excites me is the ability that the Chiefs can have to impact the whole country off the field. But to be able to achieve bigger things and unite a country, together we can do something special. I'd like to finish by saying how excited myself and my family are about coming to Papua New Guinea and building for season 2028. We're looking forward to being part of the community. We have special times ahead, both on and off the field. And I'm very proud be your head coach for season 2028 and beyond. Let's do this together.
The results speak for themselves over the last 6 to 8 months. 4 trophies for Willie over in England. That's a remarkable achievement. And to do that with Hull KR and bring them from the bottom when he first joined them as Wooden Spooners, to take them to the treble last year and then back that up this year by beating the Broncos in the World Club Challenge. Those performances speak for themselves. But this is not just a normal coaching job. There's 3 parts to it. Obviously the football and the coaching. Then there's the PNG side to it, and you're uniting the country and using that platform to bring the country together. And there's also the uniqueness of the fact that we're all going to be here living together at Airways and the challenges that brings that most coaches wouldn't have to contend with. And we feel that Willie's personality, his character, his family as well, they're best suited to making sure that our players, the wives and children of our players, they're happy here at Airways, they're happy here in Papua New Guinea. And he's the right man to do that. So we're really excited to have him on board. Everyone's really excited about what we're going to do player-wise. It's really hard, I'm not trying to avoid it. It's really hard with the NRLs and the rules to go into specifics around who those might be. A lot of players, I will say, have reached out to myself in the last 6 weeks and a lot of agents that I've met with. I'll tell you now, there's going to be no shortage of quality players who want to come here. Now, timing around rules, we have to be mindful of not doing the wrong thing. But this team will be competitive from the outset, and that's clear from the conversations I'm having, and I'm sure Willie's phone is really hot.
The man himself, Willie Peters, the new coach of the PNG Chiefs, who's clearly very optimistic about what lays ahead of him, which is great to hear. It's going to be a tough job, no doubt, but look, I have every faith that that he's going to make it work, and that more importantly, PNG has the talent to make it work. But time will tell how it all plays out. As for us, that's all we've got time for on Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story: despite surging global fuel prices, Fiji tourism operators are optimistic the Middle East conflict might be good for business.
We're working together to ensure that we create the opportunities by making sure that we've got very comprehensive and very affordable packages for potential visitors to consider.
We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. As for me, my name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic afternoon.